You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a highway safety expert about trucking safety and regulations about the amount of rest that truckers get, the issues in the news after an allegedly sleep-deprived truck driver caused an accident that put comedian Tracy Morgan in the hospital.
Wisconsin may not loom large in the literary map, but a growing group of writers is raising the state's profile. Over the next couple of months, we'll talk to a few of the people living the writing life here in Wisconsin.
Right now, we're joined in studio by first-time novelist Susan Gloss, whose new book, Vintage, recently came out. Along with her writing career, Susan is also an attorney and a blogger at glossingitover.com. Susan, thanks for coming in.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations on your first novel.
Thank you.
And it's the story of three women who come together around a vintage clothing store in Madison, a fictional clothing store on Johnson Street. Its owner is named Violet. Tell us about the other two women who kind of orbit around her in the shop.
Sure. Well, it's a multi-generational story. The other two main characters are an intern at the shop named April, and she is a high school senior dealing with an unexpected pregnancy, and she comes into the shop to return a wedding dress that she bought there. And then the third main character is an Indian American woman named Amethi, who is facing an empty nest after years of child rearing.
And why did you decide to set your book in a vintage store in Madison? What spoke to you about that location?
Vintage items really inspire me. I wanted to explore the idea that items have a story behind them, and that especially in our consumer culture, we tend to use things up and then discard them. And I think, unfortunately, we do that with people, too. And so I wanted to explore this idea that everything has a story, and that they're often second chances as well.
And there's the character April, the teenager who's pregnant. She says early on in the book, she says, "I like old things. I like the idea that everything has a life behind it, that the past has meaning." Is that kind of how you feel about it, too?
Yes. I think vintage items just have, they're just more interesting to me. They've got more life in them. I'm a thrift store junkie myself. I spend a lot of time at St. Vinny's on Willie Street in Madison, and garage sales. And whenever I travel to other cities, I always visit vintage shops because I think it's a good peek into the culture of that place.
So when you were beginning the process of writing this book, did you sort of have to channel all of that energy that went into buying thrift store stuff into writing about it? Or
yes.
Did you just do both at the same time?
I did a little of both at the same time. It was probably good for my budget that I started writing about items rather than, putting them in my own closet, let's just say.
But you must have some good finds. What are some of the things that maybe inspired you for vintage?
Sure. Some of my great finds have been, I found a vintage Dior evening bag at a garage sale in my neighborhood for
wow.
$2. So that was pretty exciting. One really neat story is that I had a vintage Diane von Furstenberg wrap dress with a kind of this animal print on it. Really cool dress. And I had it up for sale in my Etsy shop. And the day that my editor at HarperCollins called me to make an offer to publish Vintage, I noticed that someone had bought that dress from my Etsy shop online. And when I looked at the address, it matched up with her address, her office address at HarperCollins. So she had, you know, not only offered the publication contract for the book, but it also bought this lovely dress from my store. And I thought that was just a really great gesture to show that she was excited about the book.
And it must have been a great dress, too. And
yes.
The package deal, the book and the dress.
Yes.
Well, one thing that you call, or one of the characters calls these items is pre-loved. And there are all these stories that are behind them. Was it something that you thought consciously about as you wrote this, about the stories of the people who wore these things and lived with them for years before they ended up in a thrift store somewhere?
Absolutely. And that's really what sparked the idea for the novel. When I see an item, especially if it's a particularly well-made or beautiful item, I think, what was this for? What did someone buy this for? And what story would this item tell if it could speak?
And as far as your life as a writer, let's talk about that some, because as we said, you're a busy person, you're an attorney, you're a mom, you've got a kid running around. How do you make time to write in the midst of all that?
I really have to beg, borrow, and steal. I've been known to take my laptop with me to the doctor's office and type while I'm waiting for my appointment. I type while I'm getting my hair done. you know, over lunch hours, after bedtime, before work, I really fit it in wherever I can. And it's definitely a balancing act, and I won't pretend that it's an easy one. But it's one that's worth it to me, because it is something that I'm very passionate about.
Well, in general, it seems like the connections of a big literary city like New York might make it easier to get something published, and you did it from right here in Wisconsin. How did that process work for you?
Well, I went the traditional route of finding a literary agent first, who then shopped the book to publishers. And both my agent and my publisher are located in New York. I've actually never met either of them in person. We've done everything over email and the phone. I imagine I will meet them in person one of these days. But it's, you know, now just with the way things are so connected, it's really not necessary to be in New York. And there are quite a lot of writers actually in Wisconsin and in Madison right here that, you know, that are publishing and are having their stories out there. So it's certainly not necessary to know anyone or have an inside connection. You just got to tell a great story.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because we do get a lot of books from Wisconsin writers here in the Wisconsin Public Radio offices. And it does seem like more and more people in Wisconsin are writing and getting published. And you write some to aspiring writers. What advice would you give to people who are here in the Midwest and who want to write?
My first word of advice to aspiring writers is always two things. To finish what you're working on, because that's really the first step. You know, you can edit, but you can't edit a blank page. And then the second thing would be to find a writing group. You know, have some peers read your work before you send it off to publishers, because that's a great first step. That's how I got criticism on my early drafts, and it really helped me become a better writer.
And how long did it take you to finish Vintage?
It took me about 2 years from the time I started it to the time that I signed with my agent and then signed my book contract. So, you know, there were 2 years of writing and then editing, rewriting. I can't even tell you how many drafts I wrote before it finally hit the press. So,
but 2 years is pretty quick, considering. I mean, some writers work on things for a decade, so.
Sure. It seemed like a long time when I was in the midst of it, especially since I have a young son and was quite entrenched in that baby world for a little while there. But yes, I suppose 2 years is not that long, but when you're going at it every day, it certainly, and balancing it along with a day job and parenting and certainly seems like a long time.
Well, now that you have this novel, it's been published, it's out, does your life feel different? What's changed for you as a writer and just having this confidence of having this novel under your belt?
Well, I'm working on a second novel that's also under contract with the same publisher. And that part of it is... That's a balancing act in terms of, you know, promoting the first book and working on the second at the same time is certainly a new part of the experience. But one great thing is just hearing from readers. It makes you realize that's why writers write, is for the readers. And every time I get an email or a Facebook message from a reader, it really just reinforces why I write. And it makes all the late nights and the mass quantities of coffee consumed worth it.
Susan, thank you so much for being here, and congratulations again.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Susan Gloss. She's a blogger and attorney, and she just released her first novel. It's called Vintage.
Trucking safety is in the news after the traffic accident this weekend that left comedian Tracy Morgan in critical but stable condition. Authorities are blaming the crash on alleged sleep deprivation of the truck driver responsible. It's being reported now that he hadn't slept in over 24 hours before the accident.
This crash has sparked a national conversation about highway safety, particularly the dangers of sleep-deprived driving for truckers, and the issue is before the U.S. Senate with possible rollbacks in current safety regulations. Joan Claybrook is with us now. She's a consumer co-chair for Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety and former administrator for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Joan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, when you first heard about this crash involving Tracy Morgan and the allegedly sleep-deprived trucker who hit his limo van, what was your first thought?
My response is that this happens about 80 times a week, that there are 4,000 people killed a year in these types of truck crashes, with about 30 to 40% of them being from tired truckers, and over 100,000 people are injured. It's a real national shame, and it all has to do with the rules that are set by the federal government governing hours of service by truck drivers.
Now, I want to emphasize a statistic that you just laid out there because it's thought-provoking. Nearly 4,000 people die in large truck crashes each year and driver fatigue a leading factor, and that is according to the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Sounds like an issue that has been on the radar for a while. How long has this been a subject of debate?
Oh, about, since the 1930s. But more aggressively since the 1990s. And the Congress has mandated that the Department of Transportation issue some tighter rules. And instead, what happened was the trucking industry swung into action, stopped the Clinton administration from spending any money to do that, so they used an appropriations bill. And then we sued the Bush administration, the safety groups, to force them to issue a new rule. And instead of issuing an improved rule, lowering the hours of service, they increased the hours of service from 10 hours a day to 11 hours a day. And they also cut back on some other protections for the driving hours of these drivers.
Some new regulations were passed just last year. Now they could be rolled back. Why is the trucking industry hoping for more relaxed regulations right now?
But that's their business. That's what they do. They give a lot of money to Congress, and they try and stop any kind of improvements in the work conditions for truck drivers. And that's why there's so much turnover. There's a huge amount of turnover in truck drivers, which is not good for the public because you have inexperienced drivers sometimes as a result of this turnover managing these trucks. And you got to realize that they drive 11 hours a day. They only get a half hour off in the first 8 hours. These trucks are so difficult to drive. If you take your eyes off the road for a nanosecond, you could have a crash. And they don't get paid overtime. They are paid by the mile. So they're encouraged to drive as fast and as long as they possibly can get away with it. The records of their driving hours are paper logs. We've been fighting for electronic logs for a long time, and hopefully within a year or so that will happen. But in the meantime, these rules are almost unenforceable, even as bad as they are. The truck drivers are required to work up to additional 3 hours loading and unloading the truck, for which they don't get paid. And the issue that's under dispute with the Congress right now is the time that the truck driver gets off for a so-called weekend. But they call it 34 hours. They only get off for 34 hours as opposed to 48 hours. And what the Obama administration did to slightly improve the hours of service rule was to say that they had any driver who drove at least 70 hours a week, if you can imagine, would have to have two nights off before going back to work.
And how much time in those two nights would be spent off or sleeping or resting?
34 hours. 34 so hours.
34 hours off.
Total. 34 hours off total.
Now, isn't there something about sleep needing to be taken between 1 and 5 a.m.?
That's the two nights that they have to have sleep. In other words, the arrangement of that 34-hour period has to include two nights.
I see.
So that's the 1 to 5, saying they have to be available to sleep at least during those hours. It was originally 12 to 6, and the trucking industry complained, so they cut it back to 1 to 5.
So this is the rule that is perhaps going to be rolled back now if a particular amendment passes.
Yes, it passed through the Senate Appropriations Committee. They put it on an Appropriations Committee because it was convenient. That means that these bills more likely get enacted than others. And so they wanted put it on a bill that was going to get enacted. And it passed out of the Senate Appropriations Committee on Thursday, most of the members had no idea what this was about, didn't understand it, and the way it was explained was so confusing that it focused on the fact that they had to be at home from 1 to 5, and then people said, well, if they can go back to work at 5 or 5:30 or 6, there are going to be a lot of trucks on the highway when our kids are going to school. Well, this doesn't affect every truck driver. It only affects those truck drivers who are the most overworked of all, the ones that drive 70 hours a week at that point. Then they have to take the 34 hours off, and they have to, in that 34 hours, have to have two nights to sleep.
Well, now at this point, the nation has heard about this accident on the New Jersey freeways between Tracy Morgan and his van, the people with him, and this Walmart truck, and the driver who was allegedly very tired and sleep deprived. What are some other instances, some worst case scenarios that you've seen?
Oh, well, some of these truck crashes kill whole families. And there's one gentleman here in Washington, D.C., who lost his sister, their three children, and his mother, five people. And in that same crash, five other people were killed. When there's a crash between a huge truck, one that weighs 80,000 pounds, and a car, or even an SUV, or in the case of Tracy Morgan, it was a very large Mercedes limousine SUV. So it was one of the heavier types of vehicles. And there's no chance of survival for a lot of the people when those trucks hit. And often, if the truck is behind you, the truck driver falls asleep, and then the traffic slows down, they just run right over you. One of the people who we work with, who lives in Florida, her son and his new bride were killed on 95 just north of Miami in that very type of crash. So these crashes happen all the time, and they're one by one. They're not like a plane going down or a nuclear explosion or something that is threatening to a large number of people. It's one by one by one. And if it hadn't been for Tracy Morgan's crash and the focus of the press on this celebrity, I'm not sure that anybody in America would have ever known about the quiet effort to get this amendment rolling back the rest time and increasing the driving time that went through this end appropriations bill on Thursday.
Now, in terms of the Tracy Morgan crash, Walmart has said that they think the driver involved in the crash was operating within current legal regulations, federal regulations. What kinds of regulations do you think are needed then to protect drivers from crashes like this one?
Well, I don't know enough about whether or not he was operating within the legal requirements or not. The truck drivers are supposed to rest for 10 hours, have 10 hours off. They work for they have to drive for 11 hours. They have three additional hours that they can be required to work without being paid for loading, unloading, and waiting at the dock and so on. And then they have 10 hours off. And so these truck drivers can work up to 70 hours in a seven-day period. And that's just too much. It's very strenuous work. And so I don't know whether the driver in this case, when he got his 10 hours off, whether he went and partied or whether he went to sleep. I have no idea. They say he didn't sleep, which is ridiculous and silly on his part, clearly, because he fell asleep. And you're going to fall asleep if you don't rest. But it's a grueling life, and particularly for long-haul drivers, because they're away from home a lot, and they want to get home, so they drive extra fast, and they get paid by the mile, so they want to go as fast as they possibly can.
Now, members of the American Trucking Association have said current regulations could actually make roads more dangerous by forcing trucks on highways during the busy times of day when truckers could be driving at night in the wee hours of the morning when no one's on the road. And this is looking particularly at that rest time between 1 and 5 a.m. that we were talking about earlier. What would you say to that?
Well, it's only once a week. It's not like they have to do it every night. It's once a week they're required to do this. And it's only for those drivers who have already driven 70 hours. So it's not going to have a large flow of trucks coming on the highway. They could do this on Wednesday and Thursday night. They don't have to do it on Saturday and Sunday night. It depends on how their hours flow. So it's a little complicated in terms of counting the hours, but it does not require a huge number of trucks to be on the highway when people are on the highway as well. Many, 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 many trucks, most trucks that want to drive at night will drive at night and can, and that's legal.
We're talking right now to Joan Claybrook with Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety about what regulations should be in place for truck drivers in light of the New Jersey accident that critically injured comedian Tracy Morgan and killed one passenger. We're hearing that there are about 4,000 people who die as a result of a large truck crash each year, driver fatigue the leading factor.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more strict requirements on how much rest, how much sleep truck drivers get if you are a truck driver? What's your story? What do you think of the regulations? Do people follow them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
We're picking up our discussion now about trucking safety regulations in light of the crash that put comedian Tracy Morgan in critical but stable condition. According to authorities, the truck driver who caused the accident hadn't slept for 24 hours before he got behind the wheel that night.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about truck drivers or whether they're getting enough sleep? Would you like to see tighter federal regulations on this? And if you're a trucker yourself, we'd especially like to hear from you. What do you think about the laws in place? Do you follow them? Is corporate pressure, company pressure too strong to maybe, you know, skirt the edges here and there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And we're going to go to our first caller now. Brian is with us in Beaver Dam. Hi there.
Hi. Okay, I got a couple points I wanted to cover real quickly. One thing is that if you're not stressed and you're not being rushed, and I think most trucking companies don't really push their drivers to the point of forcing them to do things that they don't want to do because they know it's dangerous and they could be in deep trouble. But the way the system is designed, you need to move or you're not going to make some money. Okay, now my point of all this is that you shouldn't have to be worrying about breaking laws that everyone knows right now is dangerous by having to take off a certain amount of time at once, because when you're at a truck stop waiting to get loaded or unloaded, there could be 2 hours in between, an hour or 3 hours or 4 hours. That should count as time being able to sleep, so that when you get back on the road again, you can legally log in where you are and what you did and slept, and then drive on another 6-8 hours. And then when you get to your next stop, you sleep 2-3 hours, and then you go on again. As long as you get 12 hours of sleep on, 12 hours of sleep and driving in a day's time, most people would be able to do that, but they cheat the system and they wind up driving huge hours and then sleeping for just a few.
And Brian, are you a trucker?
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you're saying that you think that truckers sort of self-regulate their sleep and the laws might not be necessary.
Yeah, because they keep several logbooks so that they keep changing the logs as time goes on to make it fit their needs, so that they can get to the next place and possibly get home before Friday, you know, and Thursday night instead. Things like that that cause, you know, them to be stressed and force the issue.
All right, let's get our guest in on this. Joan, what do you have to say to that? Truckers maybe sneak their sleep in different patterns, and it sounds like that's one way to get the job done.
Well, a large amount of research has been done on the issue of sleep, and sleeping 2 hours or 3 hours on the run and not in a bed where you're, you know, able to really go into a deep sleep is not a substitute for having 8 hours of sleep and or even 7 hours of straight sleep. So I certainly would oppose that. I think that if you're waiting for a truck to be loaded, who knows where you can lie down and take a nap. And naps are fine. I don't oppose them at all, but they shouldn't count as regular sleep.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brian. And we're going to move next to Andre, who's joining us in Green Bay. Hi there, Andre.
Well, hello.
What do you think?
I work at a company, and I help to manage a fleet of drivers to help, you know, and part of that process involves making sure that they're safe, well-rested, and healthy to be driving. And also, I manage a lot of, you know, logging kinds of issues. So one of the things that the guest has said, I really fundamentally disagree with, though I agree with most of the message, was that our drivers need to be well-rested in order to be safe on the road. The way we've added the 1-to-5 time frame for that 34-hour reset, you have to hit it twice in a 34-hour time period. Now, there's a lot of drivers who wanted to drive at night who can't anymore, and I'll tell you why. Because they guess that it wasn't a big issue if it's only once a week or so. That's not quite right. In order to drive at night, you have to readjust your circadian rhythm so that you are adapted to driving at night and being awake during that time period and being asleep during the time periods you might otherwise be awake. If you are once a week, or let's say you're on a let's say you don't do a 34 every time, and you're constantly having to readapt to fall asleep between 1 and 5 in the morning, two nights out of that week period, that gets a little rough to keep your circadian rhythm adapted to a nighttime schedule. That makes it hard for drivers to stay awake when they need to be driving.
And Andre, what would you think about a regulation that called for the same 4 hours, two consecutive nights, but just didn't call for it in the nighttime, the 1 to 5?
I'm sorry, say that again?
What would you think if those 4 hours of sleep on two consecutive nights were still in place, but it just wasn't during the nighttime, so truckers could drive and they could sleep during the day?
Well, I think that would be fine. I mean, my main concern is that drivers, when they're taking their breaks, are getting enough sleep. So I really like the 10-hour. I would like to see if they're taking a 34, they get two consecutive periods that are, you know, adjacent like that so that they get that sleep period. And that's good. But I don't think I'd like – I think – we need to move away from regulating a specific time period the drivers can sleep and just make sure they're sleeping consistently so their circadian rhythm is lined up.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you so much for that call, Andre. And Joan, what about the circadian rhythm thing? If truckers are adjusted to sleeping at night, it's a big deal to shift everything and then be sleeping instead of driving.
Well, there's been a lot of research done, on whether or not this rule should make sure that they have two nights involved in that 34-hour period. And the reason why is that the body, even though the circadian rhythm is temporarily adjusted to a nighttime occupation, driving, in fact, you get better sleep at night. And so that's the reason the rule was written the way it is, because there is deeper sleep and better sleep. So, and it doesn't actually change the circadian rhythm to do that. So that's the reason the rule was written that way. But what the trucking industry wants to do, the industry and the lobbyists in Washington want to do, is they just want to get rid of that. And I think that the whole hours of service system should be changed so that drivers do not have to drive 11 hours, which I think is just inhumane. And that's the reason I think there's so much turnover in truck drivers. And have... you know, 8 or 9 hours of driving. That's enough. And the trucking industry essentially is operating what I think of as sweatshops on wheels. I mean, these guys are working in ways that no one else in America has to work. 11 hours of driving, 11 hours of work, not being paid while they're stopped for loading and unloading, and paid by the mile instead of by the hour. It's really a terrible system. And it ought to be completely overhauled. But in the meantime, at least this small protection of if you've driven 70 hours in a week, which is, I mean, most people can't imagine doing that. But if they've driven 70 hours in a week, they have to take off at least with two nights involved.
All right, let's go back to our phones now and take Chris, who's joining us in Neenah. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi, good evening. You know, I'm a truck driver of a little different stripe in that my truck goes 600 miles an hour and says Boeing on it. but I'm very much in I'm in the same industry. I am a cargo hauler, albeit I am flying a large jumbo jet, both domestically and on international runs, pretty much all over the globe. Now, the National Transportation Safety Board has looked at the rest requirements and the hours of service for all transportation workers for a long, long time and have made endless recommendations. In my knowledge, of course, we're talking about the FAA. Of course, truckers have different agencies that they're beholden to. The FAA has refused to do much of anything until a number of years ago when a very, very splashy crash happened in Buffalo, New York. A Colgan commuter airliner crashed in the wee small hours, killed everybody on board, as well as a couple of people in the house that it crashed into. So Public opinion was stirred. The FAA finally decided that, boy, we really need to get some rested pilots. They proposed rulemaking that would provide for much better recognition of circadian rest patterns. Pilots flying in the overnight hours would get more rest than pilots in the daytime because, you know, no matter how much you do of late night work, you never become totally 100% adapted to it. Your rest, the body naturally wants to sleep when it's dark outside. At any rate, long story short, FedEx and UPS saw that they were going to have vastly increased personnel costs and lobbied long and hard, spent tons of money lobbying the Congress in the United States, and they were actually able to achieve what is known in the industry as the cargo cutout. The FAA passed new rest rule requirements for airline pilots and exempted the entire cargo industry. Those of us who mostly operate at night and were in the most need of relief continue to operate under the old rules. So,
and your take on that, Chris, was that a good call?
Believe that you probably understand that I do not agree with that position. No.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate your calling and your take there. And Chris getting at the challenges with airline pilots and some of the decisions with cargo planes being exempted from some rules. What do you think as we wrap up here, Joan, what do you think is a takeaway now as we're in this position, national attention, spotlight focus there? What should we be thinking about?
We should be thinking about changing the rules to protect the drivers or the pilots that are doing the hard work of moving our cargo so that they're rested, so they don't threaten the lives of other people because of their exhaustion. And I believe that that means that they should have a maximum of 8 or 9 hours of driving or flying a day, and they should be paid for every hour that they work. They should be paid overtime if they work overtime, and that will discourage the companies from making them work these longer hours because they don't want to pay overtime. And they should be allowed to get enough rest. And then the number of truck crashes will decrease drastically from 4,000 down to, I don't know what, but a much larger, much lower number. I don't know the number of deaths from cargo planes, but I think it's relatively small. But then they're not maneuvering in traffic with cars and people who stop suddenly and traffic that stops and goes. So they have, in a way, while it's a very challenging job, they have an easier time than the truck driver. But I think all these rules ought to be reevaluated, and the trucking industry and the airline industry and the air cargo industry should not be allowed to call the shots. And that's what's going on right now. Chris put his finger on it.
And we're going to leave it there. Joan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I did want to say that if anyone wants to know more about truck safety, they can go to www.trucksafety.org.
All right. Thank you so much. That was Joan Claybrook, consumer co-chair for Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety and former administrator for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
It's that time of year where rummage sales are springing up left and right in Wisconsin, and bargain hunters are on the prowl for great deals. Have you ever thought of having your own?
Whether it's in your yard or your garage, having a rummage sale can be a great way to clean out your closets and make a few extra bucks in the process. But you can't just throw stuff out on tables and expect it to sell. A little bit of planning can go a long way. And the question being, where do you start?
Today on Teach Me What You Know, we're going to find out what it takes to run a successful rummage sale. To help us do that, we've got Janelle Gallatin with us. She's a sales event expert with RummageWisconsin.com. Janelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So say somebody out there is thinking, yeah, I could maybe do a yard sale, garage sale this summer. What's the first thing they should start thinking about?
Well, the thing is preparation. Spend some time identifying what you want to sell and make sure that you're spreading the words. So advertising is a big thing. You want to do advertising through, there's lots of different ways. Obviously, rummagewisconsin.com is one, but, you know, through things like Craigslist and other online, and, of course, your local newspaper. What's great about the local newspaper is that you usually get the online version and the print version, too, so you reach a greater audience.
I want to talk about the preparation bit a little bit more. I'm someone who loves the idea of making some money off all the stuff that's sitting in my house in storage, but it just seems incredibly daunting, sort of organizing it and pricing it. How do we take care of that stuff, and how long does it take typically?
Well, that all depends on, obviously, the amount of items you have to sell. But we recommend organizing items. You can kind of organize them in five basic categories, such as clothes, electronics, housewares, furniture, lawn and garden equipment. You want to make sure that your items are clean, too. It doesn't mean that they have to be spotless, but even just, you know, taking a little something, a rag or something, and wiping the dust off of items, and making sure that you're, especially with clothes, a pet peeve for myself, even going to rummage sales, is having stacks and stacks of clothes that are unorganized. And the reason I mention clothes is because there's lots of moms that go to sales to, say, buy children's clothing. And they know specifically what sizes that they're looking for. And it is so helpful to go into a rummage sale. And even if they just have, you know, a table with a piece of paper that says, you know, 3T here, 4T there, and so on, it saves people a lot of time and it actually saves you a lot of mess. You don't have to clean up because people aren't rummaging through everything because they know exactly what they're looking for.
I've done a couple of garage sales, and I got to say the most daunting part of it for me was how to price things. How do we get started? How do we figure out how to show the price, first of all, and what to charge for everything?
Well, there's lots of different options, but you should always price your items to sell and be realistic. People are looking for deals. We actually, on our website, have some great guides for pricing your items. There's some suggestions, but there's a lot of different ways you can do it. You could do something as you could actually price each individual item with a sticker. Another thing that people have done is they might use, like, colored dots. So, you know, red is 50 cents, green is a dollar, and so on. That way you can just go through and just put the dots on. Other things, too, I've seen people do where they have, they'll go to their local grocery store and they'll get a bunch of boxes and they'll write $1, fill this box for a dollar, and bigger boxes are more money. People do bag sales where they'll have fill the bag for $5 of clothing. What you don't want to do, though, is have no pricing at all. So you want to make sure that you at least have some type of a guideline for people, because people... there are people that are going to negotiate with you, but then there's some people that are going to be very turned off by the fact that there's no pricing.
Even with the pricing, should we go into this expecting to haggle with people over the price?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Especially on the bigger ticket items. You know, that may be where you write something like make an offer on it, and then that will encourage people to talk to you. Some people have even done the silent auction method where they place out a sheet so customers can write down their name, phone number, and a bid. But yes, definitely expect that people will try to haggle with you a bit.
And how about that thing you've got some sentimental attachment for, but you know you should probably get rid of it? Should we let that get in the way when we're haggling?
Absolutely not. That's the thing that I always tell people is remember that the things that you're putting out on your rummage sale are things that you've decided you want to let go of. So you also need to let go of the emotional attachment. It's very hard to sell something that means so much to you. So if it really means that much, you probably shouldn't have it out on your rummage sale. And remember what your purpose is, too. You know, if you're having a rummage sale to clear clutter or to, you know, fundraising, making money for something, you know, keep that perspective in mind rather than that emotional attachment to the item itself.
So let's say we've got ourselves organized and priced and it's the morning of the sale. How early should we start and get out there?
Well, you know, I think that actually is dependent on different regions and things like that. It also depends on if you're in a neighborhood sale. So, for example, sometimes neighborhood sales, if it's a very organized sale, they'll say, you know, everybody starts at a certain time. Maybe it's 8 o'clock. But usually I would say that sales start usually between 7 and 8 a.m. is a good time to start.
And should we hold it to the weekend, or is it good to try to get ahead of the competition and have a Wednesday start or a Thursday start?
Well, and again, I think that's regional. I'm actually up in northern Wisconsin, and it seems to be here sales start Wednesday, and Thursday and Friday are what we call the big days here. By Saturday, there's not as many sales going. But now I was living down in the Madison area, and there it's usually Fridays are the big days. So I guess you can kind of gauge it based on what you're seeing other sales doing.
Now, you mentioned a couple of ways to publicize. You want to run us through those again quickly and something that we might not have considered, you know, an ad, a local neighborhood listserv. Is it terribly important that we get the word out?
Absolutely. I would say that, you know, again, the first one is newspaper, classified ad. And again, you're getting the print version, and then you're usually getting the online version too. We have Rummage Wisconsin has a big list that we have on there where you can list your sales too. We also see a lot on Craigslist. The thing too that's nice about online version listing is that you can add pictures to it. And I highly recommend adding pictures, especially of your bigger ticket items and showing them that it's a sale worth going to. And keeping in mind that when you take the pictures, make sure your items are organized. Make sure you don't have piles of things because that will turn customers away. And then I've even seen some things like on such sites as like Facebook where they have local groups that advertise thrift sales and rummage sales too. So really the social media is huge for getting the word out there.
Here's a specific question. The one thing I had a hard time displaying was things I wanted to put up on hangers like coats or shirts. What's a good way? I was fiddling around with ladders and extension cords. It was really comical. What's a good way to put out hanging stuff at a yard sale?
Well, again, I would say that, you know, definitely you can use the makeshift thing, making sure it's safe.
Yeah, it wasn't.
There are times when you could even look on Craigslist or something like that and see if you can find, you know, from like clothing stores and stuff like those hangers. And what you can even do is if you end up having to purchase them to do your sale, you could sell them at your sale too. Say after my sale's done, they're available for pickup. That's another way. But if you have to put things on a table and neatly fold them, that's okay. Just make sure that your stacks aren't too high. But you definitely do want to hang anything that you can, if that's possible. And make sure it's, like if it's clothing, try to get some of the wrinkles out and stuff too, because that'll just help you sell the items more too.
A lot of great advice. Janelle, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
That was Janelle Gallatin, sales event expert at rummagewisconsin.com. If you can't get enough rummage sale talk, you're in luck. Thursday at this time, we'll ask you what's the best item you've ever found at a rummage sale or a flea market. Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know. Share a picture if you have one.